Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do at all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before we introduce this morning's speaker, I want to thank everyone for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to a virtual platform. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker for Native American Heritage Month, Neil Paulus. Neil J. Paulus, PhD fellow at Syracuse University's S.I. Newhouse at School of Public Communications, is a traditional member of the Onondaga Nation and Eel Clan. He currently serves all faculty, staff, and graduate students at Syracuse University as the university ombuds, providing confidential, informal, independent, and neutral conflict management and conflict resolution. As a co-producer for the major motion picture, Crooked Arrows, Mr. Paulus was responsible for Native storyline development, cultural sensitivity, and procuring financial investments. He co-produced the New York Emmy-nominated Game of Life, Heart and Soul of the Onondaga, a short documentary about the cultural origins of the game of lacrosse, as well as collaborated with ESPN on multiple film projects. Mr. Paulus has taught courses and presented across the country for nearly 20 years about Indigenous culture and value systems. He is the co-founder and co-owner of Indigenous Concepts Consulting, a firm that he currently runs with his wife, Michelle, to bridge Native American ideals and culture with organizations and individuals all over the world. Since 2014, Mr. Paulus had been the head coach for the Netherlands national lacrosse team that competed in Denver in 2014 and the 2016 European Lacrosse Championships in Hungary, where they placed seventh. He was a three-time All-American lacrosse player, which led to his seven-year professional lacrosse career. He played for the Iroquois Nationals in six World Lacrosse Championships and made the tournament's all-world team in 2002. Mr. Paulus has won a total of five professional and national championships in his career and was inducted into the Nazareth College Sports Hall of Fame in 2009 and the U.S. Lacrosse Central New York Chapter of Fame in 2017. He formerly served Syracuse University's Office of Multicultural Affairs and Career Services. Mr. Paulus has a master's in counseling from Syracuse University and a B.S. in psychology from Nazareth College. His current PhD research is about Indigenous imagery in contemporary major motion pictures. He resides in upstate New York with his wife, Michelle Shenandoah Paulus, and their four children. Please join me in welcoming Neil Paulus.
Wow, that's a long intro. Hello, everybody. Good morning. How are you? Thank you for the intro. It's funny when you hear the bios, so weird. About yourself, but good morning. I'm gonna do some of you may or may not know me, that's okay. I'm gonna do a quick Onondaga introduction actually. Let me get my PowerPoints here. Okay, so today we're gonna do I'm going to fly through a few things, assuming that there are some things that you can research, but I'm going to introduce you to some concepts and things like that. But this presentation is basically kind of some history that may be some things that you've never heard of before. And that's kind of the whole point. And how we can learn to take that knowledge that has been erased in some ways from historical conversations or history books. And how we can use that same exact knowledge to come together as a community and a group. So that's really what this presentation is about. But before I get into that, we have in Onondaga, we have this thing, and I appreciate the land acknowledgement, but I'm going to do my own land acknowledgement. And what we do is we call it the Gunahanyu, or a Handugaiwadikwi. And that what that really means is that the has come to be known as the Thanksgiving address, or what we'll say is the words that come before all others. And so that's really how we open a lot of our meetings and how we'll open a lot of our, the stuff that we do, right? So, da ona hea da wa deno he ne to di ni o di ni o guat ni gu ha. Da ona hea wa de tino he eti no ha ta owan ja de ne to di ni o guat ni gu. Da ona hea wa de tino he ne hua jino wa sa ke. As you can see, I kind of went through all of the different spaces of life. And so what we do with this, it was a repeating phrase, right? And I'm going to get into the da one here part in a second. But the ne to di nio di nio gwa ni guha is we'll put all our minds together as one and give a great thanks. And so each one of those statements is about giving thanks to all the things that life depends on. All of these things exist. And if any one of these things gets knocked out of whack or gets moved out of doing its duty or its place, its integral systemic impact on us could be disastrous. And so it's an acknowledgement that we depend on all life, of all of these things, of the cosmos, of the stars, and the moon, and everything in between, everything that happens within this Mother Earth. We must look at and give thanks and protect those things because we depend on all of them. I've heard John Mohawk say once that the human existence is the greatest science experiment, and we're still trying to figure out if we can fit, because we're the only ones within this entire ecosystem that it doesn't necessarily depend on. And yet we take action and impact our ecosystem daily, right? So that's an important thing to understand, why these words are used and what they mean for the acknowledgement. So it's not just the land, it's acknowledging all life, all spirits, right? Stones and inanimate objects all the way through. You might hear the phrase orenda, right? Which really speaks to the spirit. A stone, something that's forged from those minerals that came from Earth, right? Could have an orenda or a spirit. So this is me and my parents. I recently found this picture going through some stuff. My dad passed away 2 years ago, my mom about 20 years ago. And when my dad passed away, my family went through a bunch of our stuff and they found this picture from a trip in New York City. And I photoshopped my mom in. So I have the pictures of me and my mom and me and my dad, and not the three of us all together, because we had gone on that trip, just the three of us. Even though I have two older brothers and my sister is the oldest of the siblings, but they were all doing their own things. I'm much younger than my siblings. And so this trip was just the three of us. My dad was doing a speech, a presentation, something similar to what I'm doing today. And he took me along. And so I got to hear him speak plenty of times. And so this thing, da onehia, I want to talk about this a little bit so you understand. The language and the worldview is different. We even look at time differently. Time is a resource that is always coming and growing. It's not necessarily something that's leaving and fading, right? So you hear a lot of conversations about I'm running out of time, or I don't have time to do that. You know, it's a resource. It's always fleeting. It's always going away. But we always look at time as something that's coming. And so we'll even say within our leadership, even if there's a deadline, they'll say, no, let us put this matter under our pillow and we'll sleep on it and come to a decision tomorrow or in the future, right? So we'll sleep on this. And really what that is doing, it's allowing you to enter into that the non-conscious spiritual realm in order to allow the answers to come in. So it gets your brain out of the way so we can find our heart centers and find our answers. So even within our leadership structures and styles, we had this idea of time, and that you always had more time. And da ona hia means now, right? And now, right? Or it has a placement time. But all of our language has this really interesting time dynamic. And so we talk about, and now we put our minds together as one to give a great thanks for, you know, and I went through all those things. And each time I said that phrase, and now, and now, and now. And so it acknowledges that now. It acknowledges that we all came now to meet together as one. So I gave a great thanks that all of us were able to come together safely, right? And then, you know, when you're done, and now it is time, you know, so let's put our minds together as one for this moment. And then at the end, we'll say, and now it is time to release your minds and go on your own journey and collect your own experiences, right? And so there's always this time, that's always a present of moment of now. And you hear that whenever, even when we tell stories. I'm working on a project, book type project, and I'm doing presentations and having them transcribed. And the person doing the transcription said, you know, I noticed that every time you tell a story, you say, and now I will tell you a story about, and I'm like, I know, that's my culture. That's what I do. It's now the time has come to transition. And so that's something, these are things that my parents taught me as a young child, this idea and concept of time, and that it's always coming. That doesn't mean that we're late. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we're you know, chronically, you know, we don't have this understanding of being timely, but now is the time to show up, right? So you show up when it is time. So here's a quote from a clan mother, Alice Papineau. She passed away a number of years ago as well. She's a wonderful woman who impacted a lot of people in their thinking. And she said, we are given, and this is in reference to women, just so you understand the matrilineal society that the Haudenosaunee existed. We are the givers of life. We own the land, the mother. We are honored in a ceremony four times a year with the changing of the seasons. There are songs and dances, especially dedicated to the mothers, because a mother is mother to everybody. We say iti noha. It means our mothers. It's an honorable word. And so I want you to understand and think about that for a second. What does it mean to be mother, right? And so in a matrilineal society, we're really looking at the origins of life. So as I gave thanks to all those life, we understand and recognize that. And there are a few scientific anomalies, right, that don't necessarily have that. But there is the existence of male and females for recreation of life. And so mother becomes the birthing space of that life. So all women have this, we'll call it this channel or portal to the universe to allow the transition from spirit, right? So if we acknowledge that throughout the world and the universe, that's what I was giving thanks to, that all spirits, right? Now we will give thanks to all the spirits. Those spirits have a channel to become flesh like us. And that channel comes through the woman, right? And you carry the seeds to life, just like all female plants and animals throughout all of the world carry the seeds of life. And so we must protect and nourish those seeds. And so for that reason, as the givers and bringers of life, the women have a special place within their cosmology. And so this is what this is referencing. And so we have a women's dance, you know, we have rabbit dance and garter dance and, you know, raccoon dance and women's dance. So we give thanks to the women, right? And so these are all the things that we do to give thanks for our life, right? That we are able to live. And so that's kind of the concept and structure around this. And so from a social space, and this is where I'm gonna start flying through some things. From a social space, we have this story of, and this is where I'm gonna get quick. So normally this story would take about 5 to 6 days to tell. I'm going to try to tell it in about 6 minutes. So this is a really terrible overview, but I will encourage you to take a look at it. But because I want to get into the analysis of it in a little bit. So that was this peacemaker. So over 1,000 years ago in the same land among, you know, and you've seen the purple flag, right? The Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Cayuga, the Seneca, the original five nations. And before that, before this peace, there was a great war, blood wars. You know, we talk about rape and murder and cannibalism. I mean, terrible blood wars. It was a dangerous, very dangerous place to live. And the peacemaker had brought this journey, this message. He was a Huron man, made a stone canoe, and traveled across Lake Ontario to bring this message to these terrible people who were treacherous and evil and just, you know, just killing everybody in a very, very violent place to live. What had existed before, for the thousands of years before this great war, was the sisterhood of the clan mothers. Now, the sisterhood of the clan mothers allowed a space for the people to be able to trace their lineage. So you were what your mother was, and you had a clan. And there's a whole nother story that would take another day to tell this, a day or two to tell this story, sisterhood story. But in essence, the women held title to the land, and they held title to the lineage of the children. And so you were able to track who your family line was. Now, this is an interesting way to think about this, right? Because in patrilineal societies, you follow the father and all those things, right? But how do you really know who fathered a child? Hard to really say, but you do know who the mother was. That's really, really clear. And so that was the real way to be able to follow and track families, is to know who their mother was. And so we had this whole system of the sisterhood, the clan mothers or corn mothers, so to speak, because they grew the corn. They had sway over the land. And so that existed already for thousands of years. The relationships between everybody started to deteriorate. And some say it was a conversation about a transition from a predominantly agricultural, food-based, vegetable-growing space of feeding people to a more of a hunting, meat-consuming war, right? That was the war between do we continue to eat vegetables or do we eat more meat, right? And so that was really kind of the essence of the fight. And so this peacemaker came. They say he landed on the shores of Irondequoit Bay, just outside of Rochester, New York. And he first ran into a person and said, I bring this message of peace. And this person said, great, go to the right. They'll tell you, they'll listen to you, they'll hear you. If you go to the left over there, they'll kill you. He said, great, thank you. And he went to the left to tell the message, this great message of peace to the people that need to hear it. And the first person he came across is Jagusase, and she had a village over there, and she had she was probably the most influential of all the clan mothers because she had the most land, and she, they say, she stirred the pot of controversy and she got all these people to fight. And so she tries to kill the peacemaker, and he survives and lives. And so she then listens to the message of peace and accepts this peace and becomes another microphone or person to share this message of peace. Like I said, I'm flying through this story really fast and leaving a lot of things out. And so she becomes the first clan mother to accept this message and to share with the other clan mothers. Now the peacemaker, there had been attempts to kill him previous, and there continue to be attempts to kill him after this story, and all of which he survives, you know. And the irony is he grew up in a space where his mother and father, or his mother and his grandmother, helped to support him and lift and foster his gifts, right? And so in this journey, as he's bringing this message of peace across this land, he comes into contact with this man, Hiawentha, who is grieving the loss of his six daughters. And so he brings a healing to Hiawentha, and he starts to heal his mind and his spirit and his soul. And Hiawentha is a great and amazing speaker. And they say that the peacemaker had a bit of a speech impediment or a stutter. And so they make a great combination, because then peacemaker, or the Hiawentha, becomes another presenter of the great law, but he's also a great orator and a great speaker. And so people begin to really buy in to this partnership and relationship. And how the peacemaker heals Hiawentha is he brings them this idea of eyes, ears, and throat. And so when you hear the word condolence, you think of something sad, right? Of sending your condolences, sorry for your loss, those kind of things. And for the Haudenosaunee, we also say when we put up our leaders, right? So you just put up a leader, or the, you know, conceded or not, there's a leader that's going to be put up within the American government, right? And in that process of the peaceful transfer of power, we also have a peaceful transfer of power, and we call it the condolence, right? And so you're thinking, oh, you should be celebrating. This is a celebratory time. You're putting up leaders. And so it's really about clearing the space, right? And so when we condole our leaders and put them up into those spaces, we have a process that we put them through, and it has eyes, ears, and throat. And there's 20 different parts to this, but I'm just going to go over the first three. And so the first three is the eyes. And so they say that we will use the softest skin from the baby fawn, right? The softest fur, to clear the tears from our eyes, our leaders' eyes, so they can see into the future for those generations yet to be born, right? So you might hear seven generations, which some people start doing the math and figuring out who they're looking after. And it's way beyond that. It's all generations yet to be born, right? And so we clear our eyes so that we can see into the future for those people, right? We clear the ear, our ears, with the eagle feather so that we can hear the words of the people, okay? And then, you know, when you're going through grief, you know, so when you're in grief and you're crying, or if you've lost someone in your life, you're crying all the time. People give you comments, you can't hear them, and you can't speak, right? You get that lump in your throat and you can't talk. And so our leaders will take a drink of the cleanest, of the purest water to clear the lump in the throat so they can speak on behalf of all people. Now, we go through this eyes, ears, and throat, even when we call it a small condolence, when a family has a loss, because they're grieving as well. And so there's this whole process of checks and balances of different sides. You know, all the clans are split up into two houses. So one death on one side, the other side supports it and helps them go through this grieving process. So there's always a checks and balances for the community to support each other. But it really goes back, you know, for the past 1,000 years, is really about this eyes, ears, and throat space, where it clears the space of grief and allows us to move through and transition through it. And so that's how we put up and condole our chiefs. And so this process was going on of healing among all of our chiefs, our war chiefs, and they all agreed. So all the 13 war chiefs all agreed, yes, we will have peace and we will no longer fight. But there is one man that has to agree, and that man is Tododaho. He is the meanest and most treacherous of us all. He's an Onondaga eel man. Oddly enough, I am Onondaga eel. I am. Hopefully I'm not that bad. but his name was Tododaho. And Tododaho was also a very powerful man. He had a very powerful connection to his world. They say that he was able to impact through his energy and his power, the things around him, right? And able to impact the winds and things like that. And he was a terrible man. He was a very powerful man too. And he was able to impact the world and the winds and things around him. And so when the war chiefs, the 13 war chiefs had said that in order to find peace, Tododaho needed to agree, this was where they had to take this message of peace. And so they tried once, and he pulled up the winds and turned over their canoes. And so they called for Jagunsase, and Jagunsase came with the war chiefs, and they came and brought this change and shift into Tododaho's mind and heart. So I'm going to go quick into Tododaho's backstory. So Tododaho was this powerful young boy and his mother did not know what to do with him. And so unlike the peacemaker who was fostered and grown in the space of love and compassion and where they fostered his gifts, Tododaho was abandoned in the woods as a young child. His mother left him in the woods, took him into the woods far enough where he'd get lost, and she abandoned him. And so he grew up among the animals, and he grew up very angry with his mother for leaving him alone there to fend for himself. And they say that there's a stone over by, I guess, by the loft hotel, easiest way to kind of describe where it is. But there's a stone over in that area that you can actually, it looks like two indented feet where he used to stand and scream and wail for his mother. And so when the 13 war chiefs come with Jagunsase to Tododaho's dwelling on the shores of Onondaga Lake, she represents the return of mother and the unconditional love of mother. And they say he had seven cricks in his back. She straightens his seven cricks, seven chakras. Yeah, yoga, for those of you that do yoga. And they say she combed the snakes from his hair right? Literal and physical, metaphysical, spiritual, all of the above, right? And if you do energy healing, Reiki, they'll say they'll create that energy field and that magnetic energy field and create that a space with your hands, and you can actually feel it. If you do it, you feel an energy and you can clear your hair. So if you're struggling and you're having some tough thoughts and you're in a bad space, rub your hands together, clear it away, right? And so that's what the Jagun Sensei does for Tadadaho, and she clears these spaces up for him, and then they bring this message of peace to him and he accepts. And so he becomes, you know, one of the leaders. And then we eventually gather and create a wampum of 50 chiefs, right? So we have 50 chiefs. And the only delineation from Tadadaho of the other chiefs, because all the clan mothers select their chiefs. So each clan mother selects his chief. Tadadaho is selected as a collaboration of all the chiefs. Then they agree that this one chief has to be the one, right? So he's always an Onondaga Eel chief. And he gives up his name. He gives up his connection to his community. He gives up his clan. So he no longer has a clan, a name, or a title. He belongs to all the people and defends all the people. So this is idea of what's now known as restorative justice, you know, where people will take those that hurt and then use them as people who will defend those exact same people that they hurt, but they do it under supervision, right? And they're being watched and they're being checked on, and made sure that they're upholding these kind of these behavioral changes. So they're trained on how to do it first before they're put into the back of those same spaces. And so that's this idea of restorative justice, and Tadadaho becomes a representation of that restorative justice for our story. And so and that's where you have this creation of the brotherhood of the chiefs and combine it with the already existing sisterhood of the clan mothers. And so you have this creation of this political government that really then has a collaboration between the brothers and the sisters. It becomes unity. It brings them together. And you might hear this thing, you know, the tree of peace and all these things become the symbols of this relationship. And you might hear the reference to peace, power, and righteousness, PBR, right? I heard it all the time as a kid. And then as an adult, you know, I was talking to my wife and asked to do a presentation in Akwesasne a number of years ago, and they said, okay, we're talking about these terrible things, and, you know, these women are being abducted, you know, and the Oregon area, that was 49 women that were skinned alive and killed and tortured by this man and hung up, and when he got arrested, he was mad that he didn't reach 50, and yes, this is a real story. So this man in Oregon just not too long ago was skinning these women alive, and half of his victims were Native American women. And he was angry that he didn't get to 50. And this artist turned that experience into an artistic stage installation. And the indigenous people in that area were like, no, too soon. Too hard for us to deal with, you know, for those of you that may or may not know about the missing and murdered Indigenous women initiatives and all those kind of things going on. They were like, no, too soon, it's too hard. So a Mohawk woman reached out to that artist, and they decided to create an actual theatrical play and turned their artistic installation into an actual theatrical play. And then they got funding from a couple different Mohawk groups to do the play in two different communities. So then they had this play, and they're, you know, shedding light on, you know, this idea of missing and murdered and what happens and all these other things. And as part of that, they said, oh, we're going to bring in the speaker that speaks nationally and internationally about, you know, women who are abducted. And they're like, okay, great. And then they said, well, this is a pretty heavy play, heavy speaker. We need someone to lighten the mood. Hey, Neil, can you come talk to us and talk to our group? And I'm like, what? You know, sure. Okay. You know, I'll accept the challenge. Now, how do I lighten the mood, right? In this terrible space about this terrible subject and people who have gone through this terrible play. And the play literally ends with the loudest ear-piercing scream of death, basically. That's how the play ends. The main character finally dying and screaming. And that's literally how the play ends. And they're like, okay, Neil, make us happy now, right? So I'm like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. And so in that process, my wife and I worked really hard on this peace, power, and righteousness, and really thought hard, long and hard about it in the stories, because this whole 5-day story got translated, and peace, power, and righteousness, it's becomes what gets used. And so we reimagined what those things would be so that people could live into them. And so we reimagined what is peace. And peace, we reimagined as kind of what I just did in the very beginning of this presentation. It's about thankfulness. So are you thankful for all the things around you? Are you thankful for all the different things in your world? Are you thankful for the good and the bad, right? So there's balance. Life has balance, right? And so we're thankful for all the positive things and all the negative things. And those negative things are opportunities for us to learn. So when we're thankful, we're truly at peace, right? And when we're not thankful, those are when we feel stress and anxiety and all those other things. So being thankful is a key part of those spaces of being at peace. Then we're really looking at how do we act and live into it, right? Power. So we start talking about power. What is true power? How do we define power? And so we understood that in order to live into power, we had to act in accordance to the most written about song subject in the world, love. So when you live in love, you are living with that unconditional power, that the power that Jagunsa says shows up and is able to heal Taradaho with, is that unconditional love, that ability and that healing that comes with unconditional love, that power of love, right? When you first fall in love, those first few days when you feel that spark, you don't have to eat, you don't have to drink, you don't have to sleep, you're floating on clouds, right? Well, my wife's grandmother used to say, you can't live on love, but it sure feels like it when you first fall in love. It's like, oh, I don't need to do any of that. I don't even need to sleep, right? Or that, you know, you might feel the same thing when you first have a child and that unconditional love of that child, right? So that's what we're really talking about, is that power. And how can we have and live into that love for all life? Even those lives that hurt us or that we struggle to understand or know. And then this idea of righteousness. And this is the one that we really struggle with because it has, all of these words have different connotations, right? And that was part of why we were reimagining it, not redefining it, right? Because when it was translated into these words. And so we couldn't change the words that were being used for the translation, but we did want to reimagine so that people could live into it. And righteousness was the key here. In order to sustain peace and in order to live in love, you have to be able to forgive. That does not mean forget, it means how to live into forgiveness. And so this idea of eyes, ears, throat, this, all these different steps that go into us that I didn't share, and part of the reason why it takes 5 days to teach you is it's a training and teaching to understand how to live into forgiveness, right? And so if you do your own research into this, the tree of peace and the great law of peace and all these other things, you might read this book that's this thick, right? And you're going to see one version of all these stories and how to live into love, how to live with thankfulness and how to live in forgiveness and to be able to forgive, right? So we were able to find peace in the time of Taradaho. So I'll ask the group, and I can't see all of you, but that's okay. I'm sure some of you may nod your heads even if you're not on camera, but would you be able to forgive somebody if they ate your uncle? I've asked that question of other groups, and some people have said, depends on which uncle, right? What this one uncle, yes, you can eat him, but not this one. I like this one, right? He's nice. So it really depends on the uncle, but still, the question is still there. Could you be able to forgive another person if they took a life like that? And that's what our people were able to do in that time frame. And they buried the weapons of war under this tree of peace that we would not fight and argue against each other anymore. And there's a unification and strength that comes from that. So within this, you have this relationship that comes between the men and the women. So the women represent life. Water is life. They bring life into the world. The women hold the political title, family lineage, the title to the land. They control the economy. They raised a community to look after the good of the people. And I use this analogy of there as an archer, they would be the archer. They're the ones that point the arrow, determine where the arrow is going to go. Right? The men represent by, you know, so the women follow the moon. They follow the celestial cycle. You know, their cycle comes every 28 days. You know, so all of these things are tied to the women. They're tied to the moon. They're connected to life. You know, you carry those seeds of life. All of those things are all part of who you are, right? The men are represented by the fire or the sun, our elder brother, the sun, right? That's why I said our grandmother, the moon, and our elder brother, the sun. So the men are tied to the sun, and the fire is a safety. It protects, it warms. Every time the sun comes up, what does it do? It hugs all of us, and it covers us with that warmth, that nice warm hug that we all deserve and need, right? And it gives life to all of these things. All when we look at our windows and we see all this green right now that's still there from the summer, that's because the elder brother sun came and gave it its life, and it protected it and gave it the energy in order to grow and to prosper. And so the men have to bring that energy to grow, but also to protect. Right. And so the chiefs are the brotherhood that support the sisterhood of the clan mothers, and they fight to protect those wishes and to meet the demands and to hit that point. So they become in the analogy of the archer, the men become the arrowhead that cuts through the wind so that arrow meets its target. Does that make sense? So the women kind of point where we go, and the men make sure it hits that target. How many of you are in a family household where everything is hunky-dory until the wife gets angry or mad, right? You hear the phrase, you know, happy life, happy wife, right? So the woman's kind of steering that, you know, whether you recognize it or not, she's feeling an intuitive relationship to life and trying to steer the family in certain ways. And so the men's job is to kind of protect that space and to speak on behalf of that space, because we do have the power, right? The sun does have power. Our voices, our men's voice, have a different kind of power than women's voices. Not that women can't be loud and can't have power. It's just that there's a general different tone and tenor that come along with it that men have to acknowledge and recognize the power and strength of that within that relationship, and that we must protect each other and not hurt each other. So that goes for the women too, right? So it's a balance. Water can exist. You can have a fire, right? For those of you that gone camping, you can have a fire burning and it can rain and that fire won't go out. Meaning that fire and water can exist together, but too much water, what happens to that fire? Out. And then you take the men's fire away, right? Too much fire, what happens to all that water? Evaporates all the water and the fire gets out of hand. And all we have to do is look to California every once in a while, and we can see where fire gets out of hand. That male energy is imbalanced, right? It needs to be balanced with that other life energy. So this is what existed here in these lands before people started coming in, and we had our salt, one clan mother from the Mohawks will say, our salt water sisters and brothers, right, started coming to the shores of these lands and having interactions with us. And so the first treaty made on this land, or the first agreement between two vastly different people, was with the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee, which is such an irony that I coached the Dutch national lacrosse team still. You know, what was left out is I still coach them. I coached the indoor box lacrosse team. And in the last World Championships 2 years ago, we actually finished eighth in the world, right? So I brought them to prominence, at least for one tournament. And so our first treaty between the Haudenosaunee is with the Dutch, and it's the Tuvra Wampum. And you might have heard about this, but the two purple lines represent the two canoes. One canoe, the Haudenosaunee people, and our canoe and our way of life, our government, our political systems, our way of life. And you have these other people and their steam, their metal ship, and that we acknowledge that we will travel the river of life. The white represents the river of peace, friendship, and community, right? And so we'll travel, you know, peace, love, and community. And so we'll travel this river of life together. And at no time does one line come into the other. So our ways of life and our governance systems will never make laws to tell the other how to live. So this was the first treaty, the first agreement between the Europeans and the Haudenosaunee on these lands in order for the Dutch to come into our space, right? So now you have this, you know, really strong, unified nation of people, the Mohawks being the Eastern Door, the ones that had the interactions with the Dutch who brought in this treaty relationship with the Haudenosaunee so that they could come in and hunt and fish and gather and be involved in this area. And you have this evolution of more and more people coming in and more people coming in, and you have more and more infringements and people coming towards, and then you eventually have a battle. But and we have treaties with the English, we have treaties with the French, we have treaties with the United States, you know, and the Dutch. And so all of these agreements were acknowledgement of the strength of a nation. A treaty is a nation-to-nation relationship. That is the agreement that happens between nation and nation. And so these treaties are happening, and in the middle of all that, you have eventually the American colonies who decide they want to be on their own. And so they wage war against the British, and you have the American Revolution, right? And during that, the Americans came to the Haudenosaunee and said, "We need your help." And the Haudenosaunee Council of Chief and the sister, the clan mothers, and the clan mothers are the ones that decided if we went to war. They decided we will not get in the fight between father and son. So we remained neutral. And the American war generals did not like that. And so they grabbed a few Haudenosaunee warriors and people and pulled them onto their side. And they began to wage war on our own people. And so there is documentation of Oneida sending food and different resources to George Washington's army in the middle of the American Revolution that actually signifies a shift in the colonial forces, and it actually becomes one of the main things that gives them the strength to fight back the British and actually win that American Revolutionary War. What people don't know is the Sullivan-Clinton campaign that was going on at the exact same time of the fight against the British. So America was actually fighting on two fronts. They were fighting the British on one side, and then they waged war against the Haudenosaunee on the other. And they strategically used these Mohawk and Tuscarora scouts, not the whole community, right? Because that community was also split as well. And they went through and attacked every homestead and castle and town within the Haudenosaunee, and strategically burning villages. And you know, there's one journal from one soldier in those forces who was noting that they were clearing the lands for better agriculture. And then the man noted that he had never seen corn stalks 18 feet tall before. And how is it that they were bringing better agriculture to corn stalks taller than he had ever seen? In one silo that they destroyed of food, they destroyed, and I don't know how many of you have seen a bushel of corn, or know how big a bushel of corn is, or a bushel of apples, right? So one bushel of apples, nice big basket. In one silo of food of the Haudenosaunee, they destroyed 300,000 bushels of corn in one silo. Gone, right? So you're talking major, major amounts of food here that were raised and grown in these land, very, very fertile lands of New York State for the Haudenosaunee. And so this residual of this is crazy. My ancestors, the Onondaga, we ate cicadas, locusts, to survive the famine that came after this attack. The Senecas. We all have our traditional corn soup that we make, and the Senecas will make a roasted corn soup, and that also has its roots and origins back to the Sullivan-Clinton campaign and that attack during the American Revolution. So you had this legacy of, and this was before the creation of the United States. And then you have on the heels of that, the Canandaigua Treaty, right, which was signed on November 11th, right. So we're talking 200 years ago. George Washington made a belt. This is a belt made by the United States with a treaty with the Haudenosaunee, recognizing the strength at the time of the Haudenosaunee armies and the need for peace to happen between the Americas in order for them to become a country. George Washington made this belt and asked for this treaty of the Haudenosaunee to be upheld. thus validating and verifying Haudenosaunee sovereignty, right? And then you have a bunch of subsequent treaties, none of them ratified by the United States between states and different native communities, which is why you will hear now this term unceded lands, right? Because it really goes back to the last US treaty that was ratified by the Congress. And this was the last one that was ratified between the Haudenosaunee. So technically, we are on unceded lands right now as part of this treaty agreement. And so from these relationships, you have then what becomes symbols of a nation, right? And so you have the American seal and we have the Haudenosaunee seal, right? So we've created the seal as part of our international relationships with different people. As you can see, the tree, the eagle on top, and all the clans and the 50 chiefs all holding hands, and you have the American seal here. So I'm gonna fly through this quick so we can get to questions if you have any. But does anyone know what this means? Interactive part of the presentation. E pluribus unum.
Out of many, one.
Of many, one, yes. And the Haudenosaunee have this belt, right? And this, I don't know if any of you know about this, but this is the one dish, one spoon belt. And so what this really talks about is if we have a bowl and a spoon, we'll fill it up with food. We will not eat until we can all eat from that one bowl. And we'll eat with a spoon so that we don't hurt each other. Right? A knife can hurt each other, a fork and stab somebody. But if we eat with a spoon, we won't hurt anybody. And so we'll all share and share from that one bowl. So we have one dish, one spoon. You have out of many, one. Correlation, right? and then you have, okay, so what is this? Shout it out.
Olive branch.
Olive branch. And what does the olive branch represent?
Peace.
Peace, yeah. I talked about peace pretty extensively today, right? So we have the great law of peace, and we have our clubs of war against each other, right? Not against others, but against each other, buried under this tree of peace. And then you have peace. So these really clear correlations between the origins of our stories. Here's another one. What is this? So this is in the other talon of the eagle, right? What does this represent?
The arrowhead.
The arrowhead. What does it represent, though? Why is it on the American seal?
Yeah, good question.
Great question.
It means you can break an arrow if it's just by itself, but if you pull them all together, you can't break it when they're together.
Yes, that is the Haudenosaunee version of that, right? The American seal version, if you actually look on the website, it actually says that it's the willingness for America to defend that freedom of peace. So it actually is a reference to war, right? And it also acknowledges and, Francis Hopkins does acknowledge that the symbol of unified arrows does go back to Rome as this idea of unity. And he does also acknowledge the Haudenosaunee, they say Iroquois, usage of that imagery as unity. But it does, if you look on the US website, this is about war. And so I often ask a group, if this is truly about war and defending peace, why is it arrows and not guns? If it's really about war and fighting and defending, why is it arrows? And so it really does go back to that Iroquois Haudenosaunee influence and impact of those, when the peacemaker, to get those men to buy into this idea of peace, he used that example of snapping one arrow and then handed them a bunch of borrowed arrows and asked them to break it, and they couldn't break it. And so that was the imagery there, or the experience there. And so during the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, Oneida Chief Shenandoah was sitting as a counsel to George Washington and Franklin, and he recommended that they use these images and use the concepts of our three branches of government. So we do have three branches of government within each of our nations. So each one of these squares represents the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Mohawk. It's a geography map of New York State. But also each one of those has their own set of chiefs, and they all have three branches of government. And so each one of them have the well, the elder brothers, and the other side of the fire, and all things have to go across and be passed through each side on consensus. This all should sound very familiar to you. And then each one of those states or nations, right, represent a state space. And then the whole group as a whole has a federal government system. So the chiefs meet together to represent a state and a federal system. with 50 representatives. All of this should sound very familiar to you. And so you have this relationship and origins of the Constitution that was created and ratified for the Haudenosaunee on the shores of Onondaga Lake, which is the most polluted lake in the United States and one of the most polluted lakes in the world. And so now you understand why the Haudenosaunee are saying, when you say Onondaga Lake cleanup, we want it returned to drink, swim, eat, right? Because if someone, you know, the outcry that happened with the Cathedral of Notre Dame, what was the conversation, right? Let's restore it or make it better than it was before, right? And if another religious space was destroyed to that level, you know, everyone wants it restored, right? If someone went in and peed on the Vatican, what would they do, right? Or destroy the Vatican, people would go nuts. Why aren't we going nuts for Onondaga Lake? It has its roots of its political structure and system for yours as well as mine. We should all be working together to heal that space, right? So for me, the pollution of Onondaga Lake kind of represents this commodification and taking of our stories and disregarding the native side of it. So in 1920, this goes back to women's suffrage. So in 1920, Laura Cornelius Kellogg, who will be commemorated in a statue at the Seneca Falls Museum for Women. I was part of the committee with Congress that created this. And so she is quoted in 1920 in the Washington Herald. She says, "It is a cause of astonishment for us that you white women are only now in this 20th century claiming what has been the Indian women's privilege as far back as history traces." And so I tell you all the story about the women and the sisterhood and your space and your role in the world, and that, you know, so we're celebrating 100 years of women's suffrage. You just voted, you know, congratulations, you know, and this is a really clear quote from a woman that says, "Hey, congratulations, but just be aware, you know, that this kind of conversation about women's existence has existed here on these lands for a long, long, long time." And so this is a slide that I did for our ROTC, and I do about indigenous enlistment. So the clan mothers are the ones who decide if our men go to war, and the chiefs set that law into action. We actually agreed to go to war during the World War II. And so we sent, so you see a really high per capita enlistment, at least previously, especially in certain years where our native people were engaged. But now generally you'll see a lot of Haudenosaunee people say, "No, we're not at war anymore. So we're not enlisting." So a lot of our people don't enlist in the American forces and wouldn't unless our Haudenosaunee chief said, "Yes, we will go to war and fight because this does impact our people as well." And then you'll see our people enlisting at higher rates because our chiefs are saying, "Do so, protect our people." Right? So then here's another real sinister thing. I'm going to go through this super fast, but here's a quick question. What do these three have in common? Yes, they're all alive. They all have eyes, ears, nose, right? That's what my son said. All three of these have to prove their lineage by blood quantum. This is an American system. Right? Canada does it. It's a colonized way of thinking, right? So, and if you know anything about dogs and horses, you'll know that certain breeds are breeding themselves out based on this blood quantum structure. And so I represent one of the only races of humans in the world that have to prove who I am based on my blood percentage or blood quantum, along with dogs and horses, right? And so now you see the conversation about mascots, because dogs and horses are mascots too. You know, so we all have to prove our blood quantum, and then we get to be on the crest of a team, a sports team, to pay a tribute and honor to us. Sorry, it doesn't do that for me. You know what I mean? And so this was part of the reason why it's really not a great thing. So my wife and I got married traditional at Onondaga at the Longhouse. Generally, we would have done it in Oneida at the Longhouse. There was some other things that were going on at the Longhouse. We weren't able to do it there. Onondaga was kind enough to open up their Longhouse and let us do it there. So we got married at Onondaga. My wife is Oneida. If you look at her, she does have non-native blood, you know, in her ancestry. And so when you first look at her brown hair, you might say, "Is she really native?" Is she, you know, but she grew up in the traditions, the culture, has wolf clan, all that kind of stuff. She has a lineage, you know, her mother is a faith keeper. Her grandmother was a clan mother, right? So she clearly has the knowledge, the history, you know, all of those things. But when you first look at her, you may say, you might not be sure, right? And that's more based on just, you know, lineage and heritage and things like that. And so within that, so here's my actual family, right? And this is a family vacation we had not too long ago. And so you have myself and my wife, you have with the other sunglasses on, who says that's her mom, a faith keeper in Oneida. And then you have Michelle's biological son, Sagoi, she's holding on to him. And then you have my three kids, Natasha in front of her, Gus and Max. And then you have Michelle's niece, her brother's daughter, Riley. And here's the crazy part. Out of all of these people, there's only three of us that are considered Native American. Sagoi's dad is Taino and Puerto Rican. But because Taino is not affiliated with New York or the United States indigenous peoples, that percentage of his blood is not considered. So he is not enrolled. My three kids, their mother is white. So they don't have a clan. And so in Onondaga, because they don't have a clan, even though they're three quarters Onondaga, they are not enrolled. You have Riley. We go by the mother. Her mother goes, family, community is patrilineal. They go by the father. So she's 100% Native American, not enrolled. So now you can see the sinisterness of this and this blood quantum thing. And so in African American communities in slavery, you had the one drop rule. You have one drop, you're African American, you have a slave. For Native Americans, it's the opposite. If you don't have enough, you can't prove who you are. If you can't prove who you are, if the women hold the title to the land and you can't prove who you are, what happens to the land? It goes away. Very sinister if you really look at the bottom of this. So, and then it's still happening today. So this is from CNN during the election polls. You have white, Latino, Black, Asian, and something else. So congratulations, people. You just had a presentation from something else. So this was the indigenous response on social media. So we used a bunch of different memes and created these sort of things. I don't want her. I want something else. If something else was a person. Hey, Victor, I heard your dad was something else. Hey, you want to play cowboys and something else, right? So then you have Thanksgiving, and during Thanksgiving, we have this lovely time where you can sit down at the couch and you have your turkey and you sit down in front of the TV and you watch the Cowboys and the Indians. America's team play the Washington team, right? You didn't even realize that you were perpetuating this Western colonized thinking of how the West was won. Every time you have your Thanksgiving dinner and watch the Cowboys and the Dallas and Washington play football. Yeah, crazy. So why me? My grandfather gave me my name. My real name is Hawanades. It means his voice is heard among the people and he brings a message. And so that's why I'm here today. This is my grandfather telling the story. And you can see in this one picture with me, with my grandfather holding me on his lap. You see this guy kind of peeking at us, kind of laughing. It looks like I'm gonna try something. he's kind of waiting for it to happen. But this is me in Vancouver in my last tournament with the Dutch national team. And I was touching the water, giving thanks to the water, letting the water know that I was in its land and I was coming into its space. And one of our assistant coaches who's Dutch was like, wow, what is he doing? And so he took a picture of me. And I thought it was pretty cool that everywhere I go, I touch the water and let it know. And I give thanks and I let it know that I'm coming into the territory. So that was me letting the land know that I was coming. But that man that was peeking is the former Tadadaho before Sid Hill. And he was quoted, he was asked in a video he was doing, if you could wish away with all those terrible things of the Clinton Sullivan campaign and all these other things that have happened and still happen and attempted genocide on our people, he was asked, if you could wish away white people, would you? And his answer was this: Creator brought all of us together for a reason. I don't know what that reason is, but it's up to all of us to figure that out. So I'm going to leave you with that, right? Because I'm sure there's some of these things that I shared today that are things that you may have heard, so others that you may have never heard, right? But how can we use this knowledge and this experience, and how can we come together as people? So I know I just about took up the whole time, but
we do have time for one quick question, because I know there was so much information here and people are looking for more, you know, ways to learn more. So are there some really good museums in New York State that have the best historical artifacts and artwork of local Native Americans?
Oh, that's a tough question, right? Because there's a lot of conversations about repatriation and bringing those things back, because those are living art, items, right? So you have wampum belts that we use. So every time we meet, we bring out their wampum belts. They're alive, they're living, we use them, right? And so when you say and use the word artifacts, that's kind of like a yucky word, and it kind of doesn't really make me, it's hard to hear, right? Because it assumes that we're either dead or that we need to be put into a museum to retain that knowledge, right? When I'm sitting right here and we use those things, we pull out those belts, we touch them. We repair them, right? They're alive. And so in each one of those wampum belts, if you start to look through the Haudenosaunee wampum belts, and there's a lot of them, they all tell a story. Each one of those beads represents a chapter in that story. There's over 2,000 beads on that purple belt, the flag, right? That's actually the high one, the wampum belt. And there's over 2,400 beads on that one flag alone. Each one of those representing a chapter. War and Peace, right? 5 days to tell the story, right? Now you see why there's so many chapters to that story, right? And I broke that story down into 15 minutes, I think I did today, which is crazy, right? So are there museums? I mean, there are spaces you could go, you know, obviously the SCANU Center, but there's a lot of conversations with different museums and colleges, you know, about, hey, reach out to those people that you say those artifacts come from and ask them if they're okay with it, or ask them if they want it back. Whether it's the National Museum for the American Indian in Washington, D.C., or, you know, Hamilton College has materials from my people. You know, Colgate has stuff from our people. You know, so it's not just museums, it's institutions as well, college institutions and universities that have our materials as well. And a lot of them, they say, oh, no, this collection was not collected from graves and all those other things. But, you know, I'm skeptical of those conversations as well. So you could go to any museum, a lot of them, if they have stuff, there's good stuff there. There's stuff there for sure. Good stuff that we've put there, you know. But yeah, as far as the museum goes, yeah, in Washington, D.C., that's a great museum. Amazing building, built wonderfully. We have Native American people there. The irony there is that of the holdings that are shown in that building, there is a building three times the size of that museum that holds all of the materials that rotate into that building. It is the largest non-museum holding of any of the stuff that's in any of the national museums in Washington, D.C. And I've been to the building and toured the building that stores all of those stuff. They have a totem pole that's 5 stories tall, and it's massively big. It'd take 4 people to get their arms around it, you know, like literally, like hand to hand all the way around. Massive. And it's just sitting there in this building. And it's too big to put into the actual museum. It's bigger than the museum. So, and that's just some of the things that are stored that are there, right? And we have Native people that work in that space, and there's still conversations with there. Like, does that come back to those communities? Does it stay there? Yeah, so there's a lot of conversation. But good question.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we don't have time for more questions, but please join me in thanking Neil Pallas to speak with us about Native American Heritage Month. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.